ॐ भारताय प्रतिपोषितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वाम् अनुसन्ततामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी. श्रुतिप्रतिपन्नाथे श्रुतिप्रतिपन्नाथे यदा स्थास्यसि निश्चला यदा स्थास्यसि निश्चला समाधावचला बुद्धिः समाधावचला बुद्धिः तदा योगम् अवाप्स्यसि तदा योगम् अवाप्स्यसि. श्रुति विप्रतिपन्ना थे यदा स्थास्यसि निश्चला समाधाव अचला. Everybody see that? Samadhau. Achala. Buddhihi. Tada. Yogam. Avapsyasi. Okay? Okay? Buddhihi is feminine. It's feminine short e, the intellect. So, te buddhihi. Your buddhi. Te is your. Te buddhihi. Your buddhi. Shruti vipratipanna, which has been taken in many directions by the Shruti. We'll see the Shruti in a minute. But Shruti means the Vedas, but also those things that, everything that has been heard and unheard, heard and yet to be heard. But also just the Shruti, because the Shruti offers so many different fruits like Swargaloka and all types of rituals that you can do to fulfill your desires and to get a better next birth. So either a better loka, a better world, or a better next birth, or a better situation for yourself, more riches, more family, more children, all of this type of thing. The Shruti will offer all kinds of different ways to fulfill your desires within samsara. So your buddhi, te buddhihi, Shruti vipratipannaha, which, not aha, feminine, vipratipannaha, a ending noun, right, feminine adjective. So your buddhi, which has been distracted by the Shruti really stands for all the karmas that a person can do to fulfill desires, all full of kamya karmas. The Shruti itself, the first part of the Vedas, is full of what we call kamya karmas, karmas that are done for desired objects. So let me do this so that I can be happy. Let me do this so that I can be happy. Let me get this so that I can be happy. So your mind, the buddhi, your buddhi, which has been distracted by the Shruti, by the karmakanda, yada when the buddhi, which has been so distracted, stasyasi, when it will become, stasyasi is future, okay? So when it will become nischala, motionless, free from any activity, still, right? Samadhau achala, the buddhi, which becomes, nischala means it's no longer agitated. Right? Chala means it's always moving about. Nischala, it's not moving about anymore. It's no longer seeking. It is achala. It has become, the same root chal, which is, means to move, achala. It has become still in samadhi. Samadhi is in the self. We'll see how Shankara has a really nice definition of samadhi here. I'll do that in a minute. When it becomes still in one's own self, tada, then yogam avapsyasi, then you will gain moksha. Then you will gain yoga. Okay, so what's really meant by yoga here. So Shankara has something really nice about this word samadhi. Usually when I hear the word samadhi, we think of meditation, like nirvikalpa or savikalpa samadhi. Which is fine. Mm-hmm. But Shankara says something nice here. He says, first of all, for nischala, the word nischala, he says, vikshepa chalana varajita sati. When the mind is without the activity of vikshepa, all of the distractions, all of the projections are the vikshepas. So when the mind's free of all of the activity caused by the projections brought about from ignorance, really, avarna vikshepa, avarna for ajnanam, for ignorance, is that which covers. Vikshepa is the projection brought about by ignorance. So there's all kinds of activity in the mind that takes place because of that ignorance, right? And that activity is caused by of the mind, that agitation or chalana, all that motion of the mind is caused by the projection, the vikshepa, of myself on the creation, which means I need this in order to be whole. I need this to be happy. Right? A good way of seeing it is if I project my own being onto the creation, then I'm out there and I have to get myself back in order to feel complete. So I need this to be happy, I need this to be happy, I need this to be happy. That's the vikshepa. That's the projection brought about by self-ignorance. So when the mind settles down, and this because the avarana, the ignorance has been removed, the projection that's caused by the ignorance is also removed. So, just a little aside on this. When we look at ajnanam as ignorance, we look at it as having a twofold capacity. One is to cover the object, so it's not known. And then the other that makes us consider ignorance as something positive, it covers the object but then projects something else on it. Right? The rope snake is the example that we often use. It's because I experience the rope without recognizing it as a rope. So there's the experience of rope with the covering of the ropeness, that's the avadana, that causes the projection for me to see it as something else. I suffer from this problem here. If I don't know myself, right? I experience myself because I am here as the conscious being that I am, right? But I don't know who I am. The experience of the self experience is here, but there's a covering in terms of knowing what and who I am. So I can take I am here, but I take myself to be finite and limited. I take my fullness to be fleeting, all of these things. That's the avadana. So the self experience is here along with the ignorance. That combination of your being, the presence of your being, together with the ignorance, causes this vikshepa, this projection. And the projection causes me always to be seeking, trying to make things right. You know, I am changeless, timeless, without death, without birth or death, constant, whole, and complete. That's the nature of the Atma. But because of ignorance projected onto the stable being that I am, is a body which is constantly changing and subject to death, and a mind which is never still, right? And so what I need to do then is to, because I don't know, I don't, like a red hot iron ball, I'm always just experiencing, I'm experiencing this myself as continually changing, and sometimes as being agitated, and sometimes as being relaxed. I then have to work the world. I have to work it. I have to work the world in order to make it provide for me a situation in which my mind can relax. This is samsara. I'm always having to try to manipulate all of these people and all of these situations that don't obey me, you know, to create a situation wherein I can relax. And then I have that moment of peace, that moment of freedom, only to have something or someone disrupt the perfect situation so that my mind gets upset again. And so then I go on, right? I go on trying to recreate the situation. This is exactly samsara, and this is calling this chalana, this agitation in the mind. So now, this mind, the buddhi, which has been distracted by the Shruti. What it means is the buddhi, your intellect, which has been distracted by the Shruti, by the scriptures themselves, which has offered to you as an ajnani, just accepting your self-ignorance, the Shruti, the Karmakanda, accepting your self-ignorance tells you, all right, if you do this, this, and this, if you live a dharmic life, if you do these daily rituals, if you follow these prescriptions, you know, you will have some shanti. It's promising. You will have some shanti if you do that. And you can do rituals to satisfy your desires that will give you some ananda, some pleasure. You know? And so the mind is distracted for a while. This has worked. Because you know from experience that if you satisfy desires and if you practice dharma, as a person becomes more mature, you realize that if you practice dharma, you get a modicum, you do get some shanti. And if you fulfill desires, the things that you really want, you get some shanti. And so the Vedas is giving you a handbook. Oh, samsari, here you are in this creation. And being an individual in this creation who is seeking happiness from the creation, this is the best way to do it. And so until a person becomes a mamukshu, there as a Hindu, as somebody within the Vedic, contained by the Vedic culture, then the first part of the Vedas is what is holding them, right? Holding their buddhi. This is what I need to do. This is how I need to be in order to have some happiness. And this is how I can fulfill my desires. Okay? So now, in this type of situation, with these type of mandates, Shruti mandates for my happiness, my mind is always going to be active, right? In the sense that it's always having to work to create the situations, perform the activities, perform the karmas, and create the situations that will give me sukha, that will give me happiness. So now it says, when your mind becomes still, the mind that had been distracted by all of what the Shruti had to offer, right? So they're assuming here somebody who's contained within the Vedic culture and is living a life that's bound by the Shastra. So when your mind, which had been distracted, becomes still, nischala, okay? So when it becomes still, how does it ever become still? Samadhau achala, being held, being still in samadhi. So now what he says about samadhi, he says, samadhau, samadhiyate chittam. The mind is resolved in that. Samadhiyate chittam, the mind, the chitta, the active mind. That mind is resolved in this, iti samadhi. So he's giving the etymology of this word samadhi. He says, for the etymology of samadhi, samadhiyate chittam asmin. The mind, the chitta, is resolved in this. Where is chitta resolved? So he says, that is the meaning of samadhi. What is that? Samadhi, atma. The one where the mind, where does the mind rest? Where does the mind resolve? In the atma. So tasmin atmani ityetet. So that where the mind resolves, in that atma, right? It is in that atma. So here samadhau he's having it mean as in the self. So when the mind is resting in the self, right? The mind resolves in the atma. So when you think about this, every thought that comes up, every single thought and emotion that you have, it resolves in the Atma, right? There is no thought that's away from the Atma. And so, in fact, it's a beautiful meditation Every thought, in fact, it is a meditation. Even in Vipassana, they do this meditation. A thought rises and it sits. Any thought. Thought, like when you do japa, right? Japa is very powerful for this. The thought rises and it sits. Where does it sit? Into what does it sit? From where does it rise and where does it sit? Only in the Atma, right? And so now, does everybody see that? You know, this is why japa, if you do the japa, just the repetition of a mantra like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, silence, Om Namah Shivaya, silence. You make your mind break the chain thinking of your mind, right? Break the chain thinking of the mind. And then it puts the mind in a disposition where you can be awake to or notice, note, just simply note the mantra rising and setting, rising and setting. What is that base from which the thought comes? You know, in fact, it's beautiful to follow the thought, but sit, put your mind in the place from which the thought rises. And then as the thought sets, let your mind sink into that space also. And that is the Atma. And so now, say you have discovered that home. We can call it the home. It is the home for the mind. So the thoughts come and they sit. They rise and they sit into that silent self. That is your home base, right? Once the mind comes into relationship with that home base, right? There's now the ajnana is broken, right? Because no longer is it the red-hot iron ball where the mind is totally just identified, where there's no differentiation between the mind and its being. What the mind has to recognize is that its being, the self that is the very being from which it rises and sets, is stable. Right? That's the stable home. Now, once the mind has recognized that, it has a home. It's always had that home. But until it recognizes that, there's an identity. And so now that mind, when there's that identity there, then the mind is totally dependent for peace on its own stability, right? If the mind doesn't have the stable home of just pure conscious, the conscious being the me, the conscious self that I am, if it doesn't have that stable shanti that is constant and immutable, that there's nothing can upset your own being. But if the mind is totally identified with it, then from its vantage point, it requires itself to be quiet in order to have shanti. You see what I mean? If it requires itself to be quiet, then you have to go and manipulate the world or do something in order to make the situations as you want them to be so that the mind can relax. Or even internally, you have to make the mind be something that is quiet so that the mind can have shanti. Whereas for the mind that has recognized the self and differentiated itself from the self so that it recognizes the silent being, which is its very truth, in fact, right? Then that shanti is always there. If the mind is upset, shanti is there. If the mind is happy, shanti is there. If the mind is agitated, shanti is there. If the mind is hurt, shanti is there. Because the very basis, the very being of the mind, right, is that wholeness and that peace. And so when the mind recognizes that, then what happens is that the mind, in the Bhagavad Gita will say like this, the mind revels in the self. Right? It revels in the self. It sits in the self. It enjoys the self. Right? Why would it revel in the self? Why do they even use these words? It revels in the self. It sits in the self. It enjoys the self. It pulls itself up by the self. The self is its best friend. All of these type of words it says. Right? Right? Because Because of the nature of the self. Because of the nature of yourself. Yourself is whole and complete and unassuming and simple and stable and trustworthy. You know, like your beloved dog. Right? What I mean by that, I'm not really equating the self to a dog, but what I'm saying, what is so beautiful about, for those of you who have had dogs, is that they love you. Period. That's it. They love you. They're loyal. They wait for you to come home. They're happy to see you. You know, if you push them away, they'll just wait for you to become a little bit more accommodating and welcome them, and then they come. They're there. And they just adore you. And so in that sense, the Atma is like that. It will never, no possibility of not wanting you. No possibility of pushing you away. That type, I'm talking about affect. It's not that the self has arms or something to push you away. I don't mean that. But the nature of the self is one that it's always accommodating, right? So your mind might run around and do this and do that, might be upset, might be angry, might be all kinds of things. But yourself isn't angry. Nor is yourself saying, you're angry. Nor is yourself saying, you know, I don't like you anymore because you're acting like this. Yourself is just always there, accommodating. You know, it's just up to your mind to say, oh, I think I better check in and go home. You know, I think I better check in now. Let me check in now. You know, and when you check in, what do you find? If you need to check in, if you don't need to check in because you recognize yourself is there, no matter when you're what your mind is doing. But if your mind gets lost and you check in, has yourself changed? And in any way, no. Has it pulled away from you? In any way, no. And so the Atma yourself becomes for the mind, the most trustworthy and the most desirable. And the mind revels in it. It revels in it because it's discovered the wholeness that it seeks is something that will never be lost. It's not something that the mind can lose or that the self will in any way flee. And so in that way, the mind is always reveling in the self. So now what it says, so when your buddhi no longer, which was distracted, right, by the shruti, now is nischala. Now it doesn't have those, nothing's pulling at it in that way. Because mamukshu, nothing's pulling at it in that way. Right? When that self, yada, okay, when that self comes to rest in the Atma, yogam tada, then yogam avabhasi, and then you attain, then you gain yoga. So now this is interesting. There's different definitions for different understandings of yoga. So now in this way, there's two ways in terms of when we think of yoga, we think of one way of describing yoga is actually vyoga. Dukkha Viyoga. Well, yoga means to unite. What is the uniting? Actually, it's a Viyoga. It's a separation from sorrow. That's one way of looking at yoga. Yoga is actually Viyoga. The separation for sorrow. But this is yoga. Now you actually achieve yoga. What is the yoga then? The yoga of jnanam. So now, let me just read what Shankara says, a few words here, and then I'll explain it. He says, he goes like this, that achala, that stillness, unwavering. He takes achala, the samadhao achala, it's unwavering. It's absolutely without motion. It's unwavering right, in the Atma. He says like this, vikalpa varjita, achala tatra api vikalpa varjita idiyate. He takes it like this. It is free from vikalpa. Free from any doubt. Vikalpa means doubt. So when the mind is nischala, no longer moving, it's no longer being called out, it's achala. it's non-wavering, right? Non-wavering, we're in the self. It means there's no doubt. It means the buddhi recognizes aham brahmasmi. It recognizes I'm the atma. It recognizes the self. It knows the self. And there's nothing that can make it not know the self. Right? So there's no doubt. There's no getting lost in the samsara. And so unwavering, it sits in the atma. Then he says, Tada, tasmin kale, at that time, yogam avapsyasi, you will achieve yoga. Viveka prajnam, samadhim prapsyasi, you will attain samadhi, which is here viveka prajnam, that knowledge that is born of viveka, the prajna, that clear knowledge born of viveka. Viveka means that discrimination. Okay, so now, the yoga is what then? But try to just visualize this situation. For the ajnani, there's an identity with the mind born of ajnanam. It's an identity. Right? The identity of the mind, of the ahankara, it goes like this. I am the mind. I am the mind. So there's an identity there, born of ajnanam. So what happens now is this ahankara that belongs to the buddhi, right, is attached to, its yoga is, its association with, for the ahankara, its attachment, its yoga, its union is with the ahankara, is with the manas, is with the mind, and with the body. Everybody see that? So the yoga of the ahankara, of the ego, is with the mind and the buddhi. The mind, the buddhi, the body, the sense organs. That's the yoga. Okay. Now the yoga is different. Now the yoga of the ahankara is not with the buddhi. It's not with the mind. It's not with the sense organs. It's not with the physical body. The yoga is with the atma. Right? So that means now the buddhi, your intellect, right, has identified, has recognized the nature of yourself. If your buddhi has recognized the nature of yourself, right, then where does the ahankara rest? With yourself. Right? The ahankara means the I notion. So now the buddhi has recognized you. It no longer takes you to be itself as I am the changing mind that comes and goes, right? Or I am the body. I am the body that is born and will die, right? I am the incomplete person that must become complete. That's the ignorance-bound ahankara. Okay. Now what is it? Once the self has been recognized, right? This body, which enjoys the Atma, right, is no longer to taken to be the Atma, right? The body totally enjoys the Atma, right, because the conscious being that I am is indwelling this body. So the body totally enjoys the Atma, but then does the Atma take on the modifications of this body? That's the satya mitya. This is the whole thing. It's not that the Atma is over here and the body is over here. It's that the body totally enjoys the Atma, but does the Atma enjoy, or is the Atma, does the Atma take on the qualities of the body? The body totally enjoys as the consciousness existence of the Atma. But now has the Atma become something which is subject to death, subject to change, subject to aging. So this is the differentiation that's got to be made. It's not a differentiation where you remove consciousness and existence, put it on this side of the room, and put the physical body on this side of the room. If the conscious being that this physical body enjoys is the Atma. But the question is this. When this physical body drops and dies, does the conscious being, the me, the conscious being which this physical body enjoys drop? Does it modify? Does it die? And so this is where the viveka has to take place. How do we make that take place? By objectification. You have to be able to analyze your experience so that you recognize that, say, when you're sitting, just sitting quietly, that this physical body is something that you can actually objectify, that it's something that's known to you through your sense organs. And so you have to allow that process to take place, that objectification to take place. And then you have to recognize the conscious being, right? The conscious being that pervades this physical body, that is not being objectified. But the physical body is being objectified through sense perception. Consciousness is not being objectified. That's a difference. You can't separate the consciousness from what is objectified to put a right side or a left side. But there is a difference that the conscious being never changes. The physical body and the perception of it continually changes. It's the same differentiation with your mind. The conscious being is not away from the mind. It is the very self of the mind. That's why the mind can say, I am the conscious being. And mean it. It is the conscious being. Right? There is no other conscious being. But this differentiation has to be made between the changeless, non-objectifiable consciousness of myself and the continually changing nature of the mind, of the thoughts, of the moods, and the emotions. One is objectified. One comes and goes. The other remains constant. And so now I have to be able to differentiate between the constant and the changing. That's the differentiation. If I don't make that if the mind doesn't make that differentiation, then it takes for granted the constant being. It misses it totally and just assumes it to itself. And so the changing mind and body assumes to itself the changeless conscious being that I am. When it does that, then the mind gives its own qualities and the qualities of the body to myself. And then I become somebody who is subject to birth and death. I become somebody who is subject to happiness and sorrow, to agitation and pleasure, to sukha and dukkha, to all of these things, because this differentiation hasn't taken place. So it's not a question. It's not a question of two entities, like there's a mind over here and a self here, or a body out here and a self here. It's that there is a red-hot iron ball. Right? They're both at the same, in the same, occupying the same space, so to speak. There's nothing, there is nothing outside of consciousness. But one is changeless and one is changing. One is coming and going, one is constant. One is objectifiable, one I can be without. Anything objectifiable, I can be without that experience. The self I can never be without. So if I can make this differentiation, then what happens is that the Atma, the mind, has a self. Right? The mind now has an Atma. The mind has a self. The body has a self. The thoughts have a self. The moods have a self. The happiness has a self. The sorrow has a self. Every experience has a self. Right? Which is immutable and which holds that experience, is the very being of that experience. When that is the case, now that I recognize my being as the immutable one, the changeless one, right? When that's the case, then that yogam of obstacy, then you attain that yoga is something which you will attain. Why? Because the ahankara now has resolved into myself. Remember in the Chidmudra, in the Dakshinamurti? How is it normally? This before that Chidmudra takes place, here's the body, mind, sense organs, these three. Right? This is not yoga. Here's the ahankara. The ahankara is identified here with the body, mind, sense organs. Now here, that's the yoga. The ahankara now is identified with aham brahmasmi. Right? So that's the Chinmudra. So such a beautiful The whole teaching, when they have so many verses on Dakshinamurti, sitting there like this, the whole teaching is included in that. It's a very simple thing. It's the removal of ignorance does what? It brings the ahankar to identification with the Atma as Brahman. What happens when the ahankar then is resolved into the self, into Brahman? Then what happens? This is interesting. Now the ahankara is now for the jnani. The ahankara is now with the self, with the atma. With aham brahmasmi, as I am Brahman. Now what happens to the body and the mind and sense organs? Where does it go?
Ishwara.
Right? If I recognize myself as Brahman, then what does this body, mind, sense organs belong to? Right? Because Brahman is the self of all. So really, for a person, when we say a person has jnana nishta, sometimes we use the word surrender. We say the jiva has to surrender. For jnanam, if a person has jnanam, the jiva has to surrender. To what? A lot of people think the jiva has to surrender to the atma, to the self. The jiva doesn't surrender to the atma. The jiva surrenders to Ishvara. Right? Because recognizing that this body, mind, sense organs, everything that makes the jiva a jiva, right, belongs to Ishvara. Right? And then who am I? Brahman. I'm the self, I'm my being. My being is the being who is the self of all beings, right? So myself, the Atma, is the self of Ishvara. Then what is this body and mind and sense organs that has before had the ahankara? Before, just think of the situation. When the ahankara was identified with the body, mind, sense organs, then I am the conscious being walking around in this creation, right? In this creation which is different from me. That's this situation. When the ahankara is identified now with the atma, then this body, mind, sense organs belongs to this, right? This is part and parcel of this. Swamiji used to go on and on sometimes about using the physical body as an example. How, if you, from your standpoint, you're the Ishvara of this body. Right? You're the Ishvara of this body. And so from your vantage point, all of the cells and all of the organs very much belong and are part and parcel of the whole. But that's from your vantage point. The cell might feel differently about it. Right? A cell, you know, going up an artery, you know, being pushed and joggled around by all of the other cells, might be worried about whether or not it's going to get to its destination, right? And who's helping it, and who's getting in the way, and whether or not I even want to be going in that direction, and whether or not things are as they should be, right? Whether things are as they should be. So this cell has to become a jnani. It needs to become a jnani to recognize. What does it have to recognize? That it's part of the whole. Right? That it's very much part of the whole. And so the jiva also has to recognize, I am part and parcel of the whole. That I am belong to something that is much greater than myself. I'm warp and woof. Right? There's something much greater than myself here, of which I am a part. And how can I recognize that? Well, I can't recognize that or even feel that or relate to the creation in that way if I see myself as the conscious being walking around in an inert creation. Or if I see Ishvara as something apart from me. But when I recognize that my being, myself, is the self of the whole, then this creation is me. This creation is the infinite intelligence. This creation is the manifestation of infinite intelligence Whose infinite intelligence? Mine. Brahman, the self. This creation is a manifestation of infinite knowledge. No? Of total knowledge. Whose total knowledge? There's not some other Ishwara. Somebody else. It's this infinite knowledge is the infinite knowledge of Brahman, which is myself. And so now, say if you recognize that and you own up that reality, then you ask yourself, who knows best? My infinite, the infinite manifestation of knowledge, or this limited manifestation of knowledge within the infinite manifestation of knowledge? Who knows best? See what I mean? So, this is all fine and good as long as you don't require the creation to be in a particular way to make you happy because you have self-ignorance. Right? If that self-ignorance isn't there and you recognize your buddhi, it recognizes that the source of ananda is your own well-being, is your own self. Right? The source of ananda is your own self. No one, not even Ishwara, can take that away from you. That is just the nature of reality. When that is known, then this jiva is free, really, to truly, not faking it, not a fake it till you make it, which is also good, helpful, okay? But can truly appreciate Ishwara and see how the creation is handling all of the situations of your life and the world. The world as you experience it, watching how the creation is dealing with it and working with it. It's very, very interesting then. But it's interesting because you're not demanding it to be in a particular way to make you happy. See what I'm saying? And so here, there's so much that in this verse, it's shown, I mean, Krishna is in a way winding up a section. He's winding up a section here. So he says, let's just go over it again. When your buddhi, which was shruti vipratipanna, for everybody, your buddhi has been distracted by the shruti, offerings all of these band-aid solutions, right? When it becomes nischala, when it becomes still, samadau achala, free from doubt, really, abiding in the Atma, then tada yogam avapsisi, then at that time you achieve yoga. That's what it is. And so now, we'll see next week, Arjuna says, having gotten all this teaching, Arjuna says, well, for somebody who's like this, how do people describe him? How do people describe a person like this? How does such a person walk? How do they talk? How do they sit? What are they like? So he asks Krishna this question. And then Krishna answers this in his own way, really answering Arjuna what Arjuna really wants to know. But really, and now in these next verses, he's a famous set of verses on the Stitta Prajna, the one who has nishta, jnana-nishta, going through 10 verses or so, describing what one, a person is like who has jnana-nishta. So we'll get at least one verse, we'll get a few verses of that on Thursday before I go. Okay, let's stop here. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
I've asked this before, but it seems to me that the ahamkara, when it gets knowledge of what your own being is like and it identifies itself that way, it's no longer a notion, it's no longer a ahamkara.
Yeah, if we say, we can call it a dagda bija, like a burnt seed, because as long as there's a mind there, the I thought will be there. Mm-hmm. It's just that you know what that I thought is. Right, so the I thought remains. So if I say that now the ahankara that used to be identified with the body,
yeah.
I could say I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wish they had an extra term for that. You know, when you hit that point, where is it?
No, but if I say ahankara,
yeah.
I could just say a hum maybe.
Okay,
but if,
yeah,
but if you think
the
ahamkara, you know, it's just the making of an I. But you see, in a sense, as long as you have a body and mind, you will have an ahamkara. But we call it a dagda bija because there's a burnt seed because there's no ignorance there. But you're still even going to have the sense of I am this body.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, you know, or I am thinking, or I am feeling, because that's the experience and the part of the mind. But the mind, the buddhi, has recognized that the me, that your own presence, that when the mind says, you know, I'm thinking, at that same time that you're saying, I'm thinking about this, there is the recognition of the constancy of your own being. Because your being is constant, it's self-evident, self-effulgent. So it doesn't even need the mind to make a comment about that because the ignorance has been removed. My mind doesn't have to keep saying, oh, look, I'm still, or oh, look, I'm constant. It's the ignorance that had caused it, the superimposition, is no longer gone. That's why we say knowledge is really, self-knowledge is really what we call a jnana nivritti. It's the elimination of ignorance so that you don't have to keep bringing in a thought modification, you know, to give you knowledge, as though you have to keep remembering, right? I am the Atma, I am the Atma, I am the Atma. I am free from change, I am free from change. I'm not really thinking, I'm not really thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to bring those thoughts in because you've recognized yourself and there's no more doubts. Right? Yourself is self-shining. This all gets back to that self-evident.
So then at that point for a jnani, is the I thought not different from any other thought? Is the, you know, you've always said like an I thought is also a thought.
It's a thought, yeah.
And so then the I thought, it doesn't get shelved into the same realm as, you know, thought of being happy or sad or memory or any other sort of, you know, mental thought.
It's a thought like any other thought, but it's also different from every other thought because of this. The Atma is constant, right? It never comes and goes. And so the ahankara is always going to be checking in with that. Whereas every other thought is so dependent upon conditions or situations. Right? The object of the thought is not always there. The topic of the thought is not always there. The feeling is not
mm-hmm.
always there, where the Atma is always there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that home base for that thought is unwavering. The home base for the ahankara is unwavering. Whereas for every other thought, it's not.
I guess, you know, and you say this all the time, that for a jnani, the I thought resolves into the self. And I'm not sure I mean, why don't we say that the I thought for a jnani is like any other thought that just resolves into, well, this is a product of the mind, like any other thought is a product
of the
mind?
Well, maybe when I use, you can say that, but the thing is if I say resolves, maybe the word is not the right word, but if I say like the word lamp resolves into the lamp, means that this is the object of the word, right?
Right.
Chair, this is the object of the word. If I say I for jnani, what is the object? If I say atma, what is the object of the word?
But I guess for a jnani, the why is the object of the word I, not the mind, because I is a thought like any other thought.
No. It depends. Like if I'm using the word I for the mind, like say if I say I am thinking.
Yeah.
Then the I could as well say the mind is thinking. Right? Then it just becomes language. If I say I am tall, then I might as well say the body is tall.
Right.
Then the word I is referring to the body, or the word I is referring to the mind.
Right.
But now what if I say I am Brahman?
Right.
Then what is the word I referring to? Now the question is Brahman, which the I is referring to, is that Brahman known or not? If it's known, then we say that I lands on, resolves into Brahman, right? So now, for a jnani, when you think of your being, who you are, not in terms of the mind or the body, but in terms of yourself, what is that? Where does the I thought land in terms of who you really are? Does it land on the body? For an Agnani, it would land on the body-mind complex, on the jiva, right? For a Agnani, it lands on the Atma.
So when you say the I thought resolves in the self, it is in terms of I am, that I thought I am a conscious being, or I am, as opposed to, you know, I am the body, not that thought.
Okay, if you say if I say I am the body, the red hot iron ball,
right,
conscious being body is immediately present for the I thought to land on that, to give you a direct aproksha jnanam, a direct immediate knowledge, where the I thought and this body experience are welded together.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So it's experiential. The I is landing on this experience, which is the red hot iron ball with conscious, existent, physical body. Okay, so now, say for a person for whom that viveka jnana, that differentiation is there, now the I thought, which is a thought, but what is that thought labeling? It's now not labeling the conscious, existent, physical body. It's labeling the self-evident conscious being that I am, that is changeless. That's what it's labeling. Do you
right,
get it?
But it's not labeling that when it says I am the body, or I, my body is,
well,
you know, I am
it is.
Tall.
It is labeling that.
Well, what she means is if I think what you mean, like say if I were to say, I've gained so much weight.
Right, right, exactly.
Atma hasn't gained weight,
yeah.
Right? Or if I say, my mind just cannot stop chattering.
Right.
I can't stop chattering.
Right. I think that's
now you're labeling. Now you're labeling, and we say in Panchita Sheet in chapter 15, Vidyaranya makes a kind of a joke about that. You know, that not a joke exactly, but says, you know, talk like a normal person. You know, like, I'm going to the store, I'm thinking, I'm eating. Just talk normally, we know what you mean. You know, when use this other type of language only when you're teaching. you know, so that
problems.
You don't, so that you don't act like a strange bird in the, in the world.
A holy bird.
Isn't non-initiative really when the subject-object dissolves in a sense that you know that? Cause that.
Well, let's see what you mean by the subject-object dissolving.
That's a good question. I mean, I really do understand, like, I'm Brahman, I'm changeless, all that. I get that, you know.
Well, yeah, but, go ahead.
But what I don't get, it seems to me like there's this thing, okay, there's Ishvara, Brahman is the self of Ishvara. But, what I've understood non-duality or Advaita to mean, it's not just so much that Brahman is the self of everything, but Brahman really actually is everything. There's nothing up here other than Brahman. And that a jnani actually knows that.
Right.
As much as a jnani knows I labels Atma, a jnani knows everything I'm looking at is the Atma, is my being, is myself.
That's true.
Uh-huh.
But I wonder if you're trying to... somehow, if your mind is trying to morph another experience out of this, what you're seeing through your... No?
I don't know.
Yeah, because once you kind of recognize that in here, now in this, in this room, if you say just in this room, once you recognize the kind of the non-knowership, non-doership just of consciousness, non-objectifiable nature, changeless nature of consciousness, once that's recognized, then there's no possibility of there being two of them, because not an object. Okay, so that's done. You can't make that consciousness be any different than it is. It's non-objectifiable, so it is what it is. So if that's been differentiated and understood, now the next thing to recognize, if that has been recognized, is that there is nothing in my experience that's away from that. If I recognize that, then I am the whole. Then now, when we say the subject is I am both the subject and the object. Let's look at what they mean by that. Right now as a jiva, means identified with this body, mind, sense, organs. I am the subject and all of you are the object. Right? So I can't say, identified with myself as a jiva, that I am both the subject and the object, because I take myself to be the subject and you're the object.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But once I've differentiated my being, and that is myself, then the sense organs and the mind, which are the subject, right, are illumined by the same consciousness as is the object. So I am both the subject and the object.
They're illumined by... So,
yeah.
But how am I both the subject? It seems to me that then the body, mind, and sense organs become objects. I'm still
that's true.
The subject. But well, now
if you look at
me, they're now the objects.
Yeah, but then I am the subject and the object, right? I'm the truth of both.
Yeah, that's kind of I don't get that I'm the truth of both.
What don't you get about it?
I don't know. Maybe I don't know what it means.
Wait a minute. Let me go back. Let me go back a little bit and do it. I think this is one of the problems. Maybe is. This whole Drik Drisha Viveka, maybe you've heard it so many times that it becomes jaded. You've become jaded.
I think it becomes jaded, but I think it becomes like subject-object become so differentiated that they become so distinct from each other. Like I was listening to one class where you were explaining like sort of how one knows an non-duality, and you said, well, why is it doesn't seem that way? And I thought, well, because I'm not changing and everything else is. So that's why... It seems like there are two things. The self that never changes and everything else that does change.
Yeah, well, actually, if you can differentiate the self that doesn't change from everything else that does change, then the next task is to find out what this everything else is. And you can't find any everything else that's away from consciousness. In fact, there is nothing in your experience that's away from consciousness. Because you have a Dehatma Buddhi, an identification with the body, you have a subject-object. But the instant the identification with the body is broken, with the body, mind, sense organs is broken, you no longer have a subject-object because everything is the object and you're the subject. Okay? There's only one subject now.
Yeah.
And everything else is the object. Now the question is there subject and object? Does this object have any reality? Show me an object. Then we have to look for an object. There's nothing you can find here except consciousness. Nothing has any being. And so where's the object?
Some kind of leap, because like I can understand that there are no objects in some kind of scientific way, you know, some kind of way of like taking everything apart. I can understand that. But it seems like you have to know that somehow, for real jnanam, you have to know that on a much deeper level than just understanding that must be the way it is. You must have to recognize that that's the way it is.
Well, you understand the logic of it, and the logic of it matches your experience. In other words, the logic of it can't be an intellectual.
Right.
It is intellectual. But it's intellectually matching what you're actually experiencing
right,
at the moment.
That's what I don't see. I don't see that my experience is that. I mean, I accept that it's got to be, but I don't see that it is.
Well, then I would say you need to work more on differentiating, even if you walk around looking with your eyes and moving with your body, you know, differentiating in your experience that which is not moving at all,
mm-hmm.
is not changing at all,
mm-hmm.
and that there is nothing that you can remove from it.
Right?
The conscious being that you've taken to belong to be in this body
mm-hmm.
is not located.
Right.
The me, your own sense of self, is actually not located in the body.
Right. And can right. all this just be known because mm-hmm. the consciousness pervades the vritti? Is that the only way that this is really known? Is because of
Well, we would say there's a little bit of a mistake there.
Uh-huh.
And that, which I find to be something we all have to work on over and over again, and that is the self-evident nature of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Consciousness is not known because of the vritti. It's
no.
self-evident. So the vritti is not contributing to that.
Right. But what I'm wondering is that the knowledge of all the objects is because of the vritti.
The knowledge of all of the objects are because
right.
of the vritti, but
right.
that doesn't matter
yeah.
because you have, in terms of gaining self-knowledge, we have this experience of the creation, right? And you,
mm-hmm.
the only reason you have an experience of the creation is because you have sense organs and a mind. Otherwise, you'd have no experience of the creation unless you were Ishvara.
Right.
You know, so from the standpoint of Ishvara, you would, but not from the standpoint of the Jiva.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay, so now what do you want to say? Do you want to say that I can't trust, are you going to say, I can't trust my knowledge of this creation? Whatever this knowledge of the creation has, whatever knowledge I gain of the creation, I can't trust. And so therefore I can say I don't know anything about the creation.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay, so then you have to say,
uh-huh.
if that's not what you're talking about,
no.
then you would say, I am analyzing this creation that I experience before me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the way that I'm analyzing it is through my sense organs, with my mind and my sense organs. Now it is here. And I can analyze it, what I actually have here that I'm experiencing. So what do I have in this experience now that I'm utilizing my sense organs so I have this kind of shared reality through sense perception? That is creating a thought modification in my mind, so that's the data that I have,
mm-hmm.
plus my own being.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's subject-object,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
Now with this world of objects,
mm-hmm.
it is true in this world of objects that the one thing that is constant is the non-objectifiable self. There is nothing in my experience of objects that's away from that non-objectifiable self. It's the one thing I can never get away from in my experience of objects. But now we have to ask, all right, that's true. I cannot objectify it. I can't get away from it. It pervades every experience that I have. Now we have to ask, all right, in this objectifiable world of objects that is a shared reality through my sense perception, is there any possibility of anything in this world being what we call having a reality of its own, being an actual thing, being an object which has a substance, right? Is there a substance to be found here? So that I can say, if there is, then I would have the non-objectifiable conscious being plus this substance in the creation which I've discovered. Can you discover a substance? And upon analysis, as we analyze this creation, what we continue to find as we analyze it is that the being, the substance that this creation enjoys, the being, the existence that it enjoys, is non-objectifiable.
Yeah, it's
well,
I can see that my being is non-objectifiable, but I can't see that the being of the information that my sense organs are giving me. I can't see that.
Okay, let me take you a step. The information that your sense organs are giving you is objectifiable.
Yeah.
All of it.
Yeah.
That's all it can give you.
Right.
And this objectifiable data that it gives you exists within time and space.
Yeah.
That's again all that it can do. Anything that exists within time and space, all of these things that we call objects, that we call things, as we analyze them, we find that the name and form that they enjoy is just really a conglomerate. There's no thing there.
Mm-hmm.
So any object, doesn't matter what it is,
mm-hmm.
you find that it's a conglomerate. And you always find that that conglomerate, you know what I mean by that? Things put, groups put together being called as one thing. Whatever that conglomerate is, you experience it as existing. It is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now the question is, does the existence which you're giving it, the being, the reality that you're giving it, belong to it? Okay? Because you experience it as having reality, as having
mm-hmm.
being, as actually existing.
Mm-hmm.
But does the experience of existence that you give to it actually belong to it? Because you're experiencing it as existing.
Mm-hmm.
But now you break it into smaller parts and you find, no, that thing,
mm-hmm.
that didn't exist. But now, the existence remains exactly the same. But now these smaller things exist. Right? So now they have the experience of existence. You give them that existence. And now we say, well, does the existence that I'm giving them actually belong to these things? And you break it into smaller parts. The existence, again, does not flinch. And then what you start to realize is that the existence that you're giving all of these experiences doesn't belong to the experiences. It's the very substrate being of the experiences, and you can't touch it. So then what you find, even if you get to the most smallest conglomerate, still, if it takes up form, name and form, and is perceptible through sense perception, it's again divisible. And so you divide it, but same situation, that the being that it enjoys is constant. So then you start to realize that the very being that you give to this and to the chair and to the rug and to all objects is non-objectifiable. That it is the very being, which is your own being, because your own being is non-objectifiable. So this being that we've given to everything doesn't belong to it. It's superimposed on it. But really the only thing that is there is this being. That's it. Right? That's it. And so now for me, say if I say, okay, I look at that painting the being that it enjoys, the being that this enjoys, the being that this enjoys, I've differentiated. I recognize being as being, not as being something that belongs to the object, but as something which is the non-dual truth. The non-dual truth of all objects, the non-dual truth of the universe, the non-dual truth of me, the non-dual truth of you. There's nothing away from it. So now, once you've recognized that the being that you thought was out here is really just a non-objectable one being experience that there is, there's not is, you, you are, it is, and you know, I am. There's no am, are, and is. There's just the amness. There's only one experience of being. But there's only one experience. And you recognize that it's not subject or object. It simply is subject and object. There's only one. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's what you have to practice with.
Mm-hmm. And that term, Ishvara?
Ishvara.
Ishvara. It, as opposed to the term Atma, Ishva, like because you were saying earlier about how in that resolution, in the samadhi or whatever, mm-hmm. then the jiva comes to rest in the Ishvara.
Oh, well, I was talking about with Ishvara is accepting this universe, this Maya Upadi.
Right, so right. There is Ishvara as a term, is what I'm kind of trying mm-hmm. to understand here, kind of represents the substratum of beingness as enjoyed by objects in a way?
No, if we say Ishvara, all we're talking about when we say Ishvara yeah. is Brahman mm-hmm. with the Maya Upadi, with this whole time-space creation. Ishvara with Maya is what we, Brahman with Maya is what we call Ishvara. If we just want to talk about Brahman as Satchitananda, we say Brahman, but Brahman with the Maya Upadi, we call Ishvara. You know?
Well, discipline position, like in terms of jivatvam, I understand that, and but in terms of the creation, how do we do that?
Well, in terms of the creation with Ishvara, because there's no ajnanam. Remember when we say ajnanam as avarna vikshepa, ignorance has these two, covering and projection. Vikshepa is projection. For Ishvara, there's no avarana for Maya. There's just the vikshepa, the projection.
Right.
And so for Ishvara, there's no ignorance to say there's a superimposition.
But what I mean is, how do we as jivas, what is the dynamic, or how do you describe that in terms of what we're doing to the creation? I mean, I understand how we're doing it to the body, you know, but I don't understand how are we doing that to the creation?
Well, just because in a couple of ways. Existence, if I say, I don't see existence as the noun, right? I don't see these as qualifiers of existence.
Mm-hmm.
I say that this exists because this lamp is here. It is, right? So this lamp is what is existing. It's not that there's existence. And this lamp enjoys the existence.
So we superimpose the objects upon existence.
Yeah, or existence upon the object, really. Okay. Either way you want to do that. Uh-huh. Also in reference, like I'm an existent object, you are an existent object, you are an existent object, because the object is, there it exists. Right? Because the object is, it exists. So existence has almost erased the word, mm-hmm. and we just get the lamp is. Mm-hmm. Right? Right. Then, what about in terms of ananda, the wholeness of yourself, is then superimposed on the world? I want this, or I need this to be whole, to be complete.
What,
it's just
what is that called in Sanskrit?
Adhyasa.
It's called
anyonya. Anyonya means anya, other.
Is that
means mutual.
Adhyaropa
apavada. Adhyaropa apavada is the superimposition and then taking it back. It's the negation of the superimposition. But anyonya adhyasa means mutual superimposition.
Well, I got a little lost. So you're saying the lamp is, but didn't you just analyze it and it doesn't?
Yeah, no, but she's talking about the mutual superimposition where you don't know that there is one existence, which is the being of all that is. So existence is the noun. Rather, we experience this creation, every object of it existing, as though the object itself is. Because the object, you know, the object is, when the object dies, there, then that object will no longer exist.
That's a superimposition.
Yeah. We don't see existence as the noun.
And
that is changeless.
The adjectives are the adjectives, right?
Yeah. When he says that, he has to work with the word attributes, though, because you don't want to look at existence having a bunch of attributes.
Right.
Right? Because existence doesn't change.
Right.
It's non-dual.
Right.
So he does say that. You just have to understand what he means in the context.
You know, I've got another question, too. You said the I thought dissolves into...
Resolves. Or dissolves?
Dissolves or resolves, or I don't know if that really matters, but yeah, dissolves into the Atma, not into Ishvara. Did you say that? I heard you say at some point.
I said two different things.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I said that when we talk about surrender,
yeah,
we're surrendering, the jiva surrendering into Ishvara. Right?
Yeah, not
when I'm talking
the
about,
Atma, you said.
Yeah, not to the Atma.
Yeah, that was the other question I had, actually.
Yeah.
You can, but that was a different question.
Okay, well, that question is the body, mind, sense organs are part of the creation. They're part of Ishvara. And so the jiva recognizes this body, mind, sense organs belong to Ishvara. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the surrender of the body, mind, sense organs to Ishvara. Now, in terms of the ahankara is usually... Red Hot has the anyonya adyasa, the mutual superimposition, where the I thought lands on the body as a conscious being, the mind as a conscious being, Red Hot Iron Ball. Right? But for the jnani, because of the viveka jnanam, the discriminative knowledge, now the ahankara resolves into the self, into the atma. In other words, it labels the atma as Brahman, the aham brahmasmi. Right? Instead of just like when, for the Ajnani, the Ahankara lands here. This is the direct, immediate location. The Aparoksha Jnana, the direct, immediate knowledge is this body, the cognition. I am this body.
Yeah, I think that I got that, actually. I mean,
but now,
okay.
So you have knowledge.
Uh-huh.
And you're thinking of your own being, yourself. Does it resolve in the body, or does it resolve into you? The conscious being that you are.
Into me.
Yeah. That's
right.
Into
just,
you as Atma.
Right. It was just like the terminology. When you said the I thought resolves, I think you said resolves into the Atma and not into Ishvara. I was just kind of wondering, why does it resolve into Ishvara? You know?
I didn't mean to say that it resolves into the Atma and not into Ishvara. It can as well resolve in, if you say like this.
Uh-huh.
You can say it resolves into the Atma, it resolves into the Ishvara. You're saying the same thing.
Okay.
Because then you realize that the Atma is Ishvara.
Okay,
right?
Because that's exactly... I just wanted to know about that.
So maybe I misspoke. I don't remember saying it in that way. But if I did, I misspoke. Because I was talking about the jiva surrendering into Ishvara, right? And then the ahankara resolves into the Atma.
Yeah.
If the ahankara resolves into the Atma, you can say the ahankara resolves into Ishvara if you know that the Atma is Ishvara.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you say, I am Ishvara, you can say that. You just have to make sure that you're not identifying with the jiva.
And so you can also say, I'm Atma.
Yeah. You can say, I am Atma, I am Brahman, I am Ishvara. Mm-hmm. All are absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to know what you're talking about. Like, I think the whole vision, really, is I am Ishvara.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
means you understand. If you say, I am Ishvara, what you're really saying is, I am the whole. So that's actually the correct thing to say. But in the teaching, the teaching methodology, we have to first differentiate the Atma from the body, because if you don't make that differentiation, then the body is saying, I am Ishvara. Mm-hmm. Or the Jiva is saying, I am Ishvara. The Jiva can't say, I am Ishvara.
But right? It can resolve into Ishvara.
Yeah. The Jiva surrenders into Ishvara, mm-hmm. recognizing that the Atma is Brahman. Mm-hmm. Right? If you recognize the Atma is Brahman, then you can say, I am Ishvara. Because you recognize I am the Atma, which is Brahman, and Brahman is Ishvara. Mm-hmm.
Right? But you still could say that from a body-mind complex, though,
too. We have to say, no. As body-mind, you have to say, I'm part of Ishvara. Mm-hmm. Right? Because this body-mind sense organs is not Ishvara. It's part of Ishvara. Like the wave won't say, I am the ocean. It would say, I am part of the ocean. Mm-hmm. Right? So the wave is part and parcel of the ocean. Whereas the ocean can say, you know, I include all the waves. The wave would say, I'm part of the ocean.
So in a way, it's Atma ocean, Ishvara wave?
No. No, it's Atma water. The Atma is water. The wave is the Jiva. The ocean is the is Ishvara.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I've heard these analogies, including iron ball. And like iron ball, I'm completely lost because I can only remember Swamiji talking about it and I can't remember the essential meaning of it. And from earlier experience with you, even that analogy of rope snake, I realized when you explained it that I only partly understood it.
Yeah. So probably,
I'll
have to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Can I ask one last question, which was, you know, very often when you talk of, and when you said today about myself being completely accommodating, myself is never going to push my mind away, myself is, you know, give the analogy to
talk.
Well, we talk of it in all these positives, but actually myself is also not going to, you know, it doesn't have negative attributes, but it doesn't have positive in the way of opposites, you know, it doesn't have the positive attributes either. So it's not going to push me away, but it's not going to pull me either. It's not going to hurt me, but it's not going to reach out and help me either. Right?
Yes, and that's why, you know, the mind pulls itself up by its bootstraps. Mm-hmm. What we have to say is that the Atma is always there if you seek it.
So, and then what it leads to is that I really don't understand why it is labeled, why the description of Ananda, I don't mean Ananda in a bliss, you know, mental experience kind of a way. But why is that attribute given to Satchit? I understand, and I don't understand Ananda. Why Ananda? You know, what is it? Because it is Sat and Chit, because it's always there, it's never changing.
No, not exactly. That's why sometimes in the guided meditations, I'll say, when you're just sitting there with your own being, just the conscious being that you are, what is it like? What are you like? What is that being like? Then I ask, why would that being that you are be labeled Ananda? Why would it be labeled the beloved? What about it is beloved? So that's something to be discovered. I can go another way and say that Ananda is actually Ananta, that which is limitless, right? Limitless being. And so limitless being reflected in the mind is what we call Ananda. Mm-hmm. That's taking it as a lecture. But there's more to it than that. And that your being, the being that you are, consciousness that you are, what is it like to be you? What is this awareful being like? What is its affect? I don't mean an affect that comes and goes, but just the being. Of me.
But is it, when you
say, is it desirable?
Right, but all of those notions are mental notions, aren't
they? No, they're not. No. Well, no. Oh, no. Okay, wait a minute. The word desirable is mental notion, but now, in terms of the mind, the nature of the mind, does it desire to be with the self or away from the self?
Right, but that's talking about the mind, right?
Yes, but if you say, yes, the mind desires to be with the self,
mm-hmm.
okay, then I ask you why.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it desire to be with the self? What is the nature of the self that makes the mind mm-hmm. desire to be with it? So I want you to notice that.
Mm-hmm.
The self is not a mental construct.
Right.
The mind may desire the self. We say, oh, the mind desires the self, accepting that the mind wants that belongs to the mind. But I'm saying now, what is it about the self that makes the mind want it?
Yeah, I think that's the thing, that the self is not a mental concept, and that's why the moment we use language and we say, you know, things like, what is the nature of the self, all of those seem to be just in the...
Yeah, Kiki, but this
mind.
Gets back again to missing what we mean by self-evident. Because the self is self-evident, no matter what the mind is talking about it or asking about it, those are all questions and things that the mind is
That's
doing,
right?
That's
right.
True. That's
right.
True. But it's asking questions and noticing things about something which is self-evident
mm-hmm.
and is not being... changed or manipulated or done anything to by the asking of those questions. It's self-shining and it remains exactly the same. You know, just like, say your mind is thinking about this or feeling that, the self that's illumining it remains exactly the same. It is what it is. So now if this mind starts asking a bunch of questions and say, well, what is this self like? These are all questions it's asking.
Right.
But the mind itself now is noticing what this self-evident being is like. How would it describe it? And yes, it's using language, but it's language that you understand because the language that you're using is describing a self-evident experience. And that's, in fact, why we can use words at all. It's because since the self is there and is your own self-evident experience, I can use words to point to it and help you to differentiate it, because that thing is there to be differentiated so you can recognize what I'm talking about.
So is the kind of the answer to that question really, why does the mind, wants the self so much? Is that just, like, why does the moth like to fly into the flame?
Yeah.
It's just kind of just like that, right?
Well, I wouldn't say just like that. Say if you say like this, as an ignorant person, why do you want this object? Why do you go toward this object instead of that object? What is it that's appealing? Or you could say ananda. So I think this object will make me happy. Right? So there's some reason that you're seeking it. What is it that you're actually seeking when in samsara? What is it when you're seeking an object or seeking a situation? What are you actually seeking?
Hmm.
Yeah, I meant it more like, not from a desirous standpoint, but from the analogy more like from that the moth recognizes the essence in the light, and so it feels drawn.
Naturally drawn toward it.
Yeah. So,
that's right.
And so the mind feels actually naturally drawn to the self.
Right.
Because something deep inside recognizes that's where it belongs.
Yes, and now what I'm asking you to notice, because the self is self-evident, your own presence,
mm-hmm.
What is so desirable about it? What is that quality?
The truth of that.
Well, yeah, but what is that in terms of experientially?
Mm-hmm.
The experience, mm-hmm. the
That's
experiential
like,
nature of your own being.
Right.
Yeah. What is so desirable about your own being that causes the moth to go toward the light, that causes the mind to love it? What about it? What about it is so lovable, so desirable? There's nothing else like the self. It is what it is. So it's just a question of you noticing what that is.
And describing it in different ways, but it's not about the description.
No, it's about the noticing
yeah.
the truth of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good, actually.
Mm-hmm. It's a good note to end on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.